Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it's a C3 project. We're going to talk about back pain. Jess Mason has two real physicians with her, a PA resident and an MD resident. And they are going to take us through an actual patient encounter, a real patient encounter, one that is not fake, but actually real. Let's go.
Who are my residents today?
My name's Andrea Sanaya.
Great.
My name's John Ramos.
And John, what's your background?
I graduated from PA school in May, and I'm licensed as a physician assistant, and I started an emergency medicine residency at UCSF Fresno.
Fantastic. And Dr. Anaya?
I went to medical school at UCSF, and I'm in a PGY3 here at UCSF Fresno in emergency medicine.
Great. Okay. So I have a senior resident, and I have a PA resident. Fantastic. I have a case for us today, guys.
Okay.
Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
We're going to see this patient together over here, who is unfortunately roomed in the hallway, but we're going to go assess her.
And obviously, for the record, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, these patient interviews that we do are edited and truncated, and obviously not all of the stuff that you would talk about. But we just want to get the mind turning over about what you think might be going on, what questions you might ask, what differential diagnosis you should be developing.
Okay, this is recording. It's okay with you that I record your voice?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So can you tell me what was it that brought you to the ER?
I woke up a couple weeks ago and went to get out of my bed and felt something pop. And gradually the pain started growing. And last night I had a fever and my parents were concerned, so they brought me in. And
so it started pretty suddenly?
Yeah, it took two and a half weeks for it to get this bad, but...
How old are you?
30.
And do you have any other medical problems?
No, pain hasn't stopped, nothing.
What's it feel like? Can you describe it as clearly as you can for me?
It feels like you can't pick anything up, you can't sit, stand, lay. You just want it to go away. It's reoccurring and annoying.
And you said last night you had a fever?
Mm-hmm.
Was that the first time you had a fever?
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel, or have you been incontinent at all, like accidentally going to the bathroom, urinating, or incontinence?
Yesterday, yeah. I had an accident, but that was the only one.
And was that urine or stool?
Urine. All of a sudden, yeah, I felt like I had to go to the bathroom really bad, and I just went.
So let's go back to our PA and MD residents and do a little pimping, shall we?
Okay, so this lady is here with back pain, pretty significant back pain. And there's certain things in the ED that we need to be aware of, certain diagnoses that need to be on our mind that we need to always consider for any patient who's coming in with back pain. So why don't we just start with the differential for back pain badness. And John, maybe you could start. Since you're the senior resident, you can help him out.
Cauda equina syndrome.
Great.
Osteomyelitis, mm-hmm. Spinal stenosis, mm-hmm. Osteoarthritis, an abscess, epidural abscess.
That's good. So we got things that are affecting the spine, right? Mm-hmm. We got things that are infectious. You're telling me things that are maybe causing some sort of compression on the spinal cord.
Aortic aneurysm?
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely something that we'd want to consider. So this patient, she's only 30, but we're going to talk more about AAAs in just a second. Absolutely should be on the differential for patients with back pain, with something potentially bad going on.
Aortic dissection, that is do not miss. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously there's like unstable fractures.
Yeah, there's one more I want to add in there, and it wouldn't necessarily be for her, for someone who's 30, although it potentially could be. Maybe someone a little older, and maybe someone who's also telling you that they've had unexplained weight loss.
Yeah, and then, yeah, obviously cancer.
Right.
You know, any mass effect tumors.
Yeah, no, I think that covers sort of the main things that we don't want to miss.
All right, thanks to our patient, to our stellar residents, and Dr. Mason. We're going to come back to them in a little while, but let's get into the didactic part of the program now. I want to give you sort of a summary at the beginning, then a Stuart and Mel discussion, then the summary at the end, because the concept here is pretty simple, but I think you just need to go over it a couple of times. So here is my basic approach to back pain. The basic approach to back pain is this. The overwhelming majority of people with back pain have nothing serious wrong with them, need no tests, they just need to go back to their normal activities. You give them a little bit of analgesia and they'll do fine. But a few patients who come in with back pain have something very serious. And so what you need to do is to pick out either the bad causes of back pain and think about those and ask specific questions which might rule in a bad cause of back pain as a possibility, or you think about the red flags, those things in the history and physical exam that suggest that maybe this is a bad cause of back pain. So if you think about what are the bad diseases that can cause back pain that we're worried about in the emergency department, they include vascular disease like abdominal aortic aneurysm, and of course, as mentioned, thoracic aortic dissection, which can, you know, strip down and give you back pain. Cancer as a group with metastasis, for example. Infections, and there's a variety, but in the bone, around the spinal cord, that kind of stuff. Anything that's producing midline bad neurological complaints, like you're pooping on yourself or you're weeing on yourself because you have spinal cord compression, and fractures, because fractures can lead to instability and that can result in spinal cord compression, and that's about it. So an alternate way to think about this is think about it in terms of red flags. What things on the history and the physical examination suggest a bad thing?
Red flag.
Well, everybody's list's a little bit different, but it basically goes like this. If you're really young or if you're really old, that suggests that you could have something bad. Age less than 20 or over 55 or 60, for example. If you've had a recent history of trauma, that suggests that you could have a fracture. If you have constant, progressive, non-mechanical back pain, that suggests things like cancer. If you have thoracic pain, that's a bit of a concern. If you have a past medical history of malignancy, that predicts that the back pain could be from malignancy. If you've had prolonged use of steroids, then you get osteoporosis and you're more at risk for fractures. If you're a drug user, have immunosuppression or HIV, which is a form of immunosuppression, then you might be at risk for infection. If you're systemically unwell, you have fevers, you have chills, suggest cancer or suggest an infection. If you have unexplained weight loss, again, suggest cancer or unexplained infection that's chronic. If you have widespread neurological symptoms, including Cauda equina syndrome, if you're peeing on yourself, if you're pooping on yourself, if you can't walk, these suggest a bad neurological thing is going on. And obviously, if you just have fever itself, fever plus back pain is bad. Now, we're going to go into these in more detail, but notice the subtle difference between it. You can think about it as what are the bad causes of back pain? Vascular, cancer, fractures, cord compression syndromes, a variety of bad sort of paraspinal infections. Or you can just think of it as a much longer list of what are all the bad red flags in the history and the physical, which makes me think I need to go further. One last thing to say. You can do lab testing and screening, ESRs, CBCs for infection, that kind of stuff. They're not very good. If you're concerned about one of the really bad causes of back pain, the summary, this is very much a summary, is that you should image the patient either with a good CT scan or with an MRI, because a good CT scan or an MRI will generally rule out, if you've got an abdominal aortic aneurysm, whether you have a fracture, whether you have cancer, and whether you have a spinal cord compression. And CBCs and ESRs and all that stuff is useless. And then the other thing to say is, particularly for the younger practitioners, is that plain films are basically useless. Plain films are basically useless for everything except fracture. And they are really useless for screening. Somebody comes in, they've really got no red flags, they've got no risk factors for bad things, but I'll just do a plain film just to be sure. That's basically useless. You use plain films because you're worried about fracture, either in the young person or in the old person or in the trauma patient. Yes, you can do plain film screening. But if you're worried about spinal epidural abscess, an osteomyelitis, a cancer, abdominal aortic aneurysm, plain films are all useless. Go to the test that you really need, which is good imaging with CT scanning or MRI. All right, let's have the discussion, and then I'm going to say this same thing in another way at the end.
So when it comes to lower back pain, I would have to say, let's get this out of the way right at the beginning. A lot of ER docs kind of, I don't know what, roll their eyes. They kind of see this as what I would call a pedestrian complaint. Like, yes. It's, you know what I mean? You would agree,
dying.
Would you? Yeah.
Yeah, you're not dying. I'm not going to put a surgical airway in you. You're just another back pain patient.
There's a bias there, right? There's a bias. And I think a lot of that, Mel, is probably part and parcel with this whole opioid epidemic that we're undergoing. You know, back pain is one of the main complaints that shows up on these charts when we're auditing and we're looking at opioid use. So, you know, it's not a surprise. But the fact is that probably that attitude that we have, you know, that kind of, oh no, not another lower back pain at 2 a.m. and, you know, in awful pain and that kind of thing, probably doesn't help, right? It probably isn't. And so probably the first thing I would say is that, you know, have a fresh look, have a fresh attitude. One of the main ways you can allay some of this bias that goes on and you can get a good start is to really deal with the patient's main issue first, the pain. And then yes. once, right? And that's what a lot of us do. We really are aggressive about, hey, listen, before we get into this, I know you're in pain, let's deal with that. And I'm not going to belabor the point. Obviously, there's a whole discussion to be had there. And people want to know, do you give opioids? Do you not? You know, I try to avoid them. And you probably do too. But whatever, we offer them something. We try to get that reduction of pain going before we really get into interrogating them, basically, to make sure they don't have something bad, right?
Yeah, right. So this has become a theme of yours then. So somebody who comes in with a pain presentation, let's deal with the pain so that we can get to the next stage, which is getting a good history, physical exam, and working out what's going on. Got it.
When it comes to back pain, Mel, I feel, though, that as you get more experienced, I shouldn't say this because probably tomorrow I'm going to miss something horrible, right? But I do find that as you get more into it, as the years pass, you can start to sniff out what's different than the typical pattern, because there is a real pattern to the way that lower back pain that's mechanical and that's not malignant, that's not going to be a huge problem, presents, right? There is a pattern there.
Here's how it goes, Stuart. We know that most back pain is musculoskeletal, non-specific, non-life-threatening, though it is a bit of a pain to that person. We know that most of those people, the right therapy is to get them back to usual activity and that pain will go away. We know that lots of people have back pain, 60% or more of the US population will have back pain at some point in their life, and it's probably a function of standing on two legs, okay? So we know all that. So in the emergency department or even in the urgent care setting, there's a couple of serious causes of back pain we must determine pretty quickly or we're going to get a lot of morbidity and even mortality. So those bad things are abdominal aortic aneurysm, Cauda equina syndrome, infections, cancers, and fractures. So you're going to take us through how we pick out those sort of four or five bad causes of back pain from the sea of people who have musculoskeletal, never work it out, but it's never going to kill them back pain.
Okay, so let's start with the most serious thing first that's got to be on the top of your differential, not on everyone, but on older people and people that have a history of hypertension, and that's AAA.
AAA.
There's really two major risk factors for having a AAA. So who are the patients that you think of as someone who may be having back pain secondary to a AAA?
Somebody who smokes.
That's good. Okay.
And hypertensive.
Hypertension, yeah. Really, hypertension is the big one. And the other thing is the patient's age. Because even if I have high blood pressure, I'm probably not going to have a AAA. But someone who is really over the age of 50, who's had time with their hypertension, that's who you want to be worrying about. So that should rise higher up on your differential.
So we're talking about abdominal aortic aneurysm. We're talking about the risk factors for that, hypertension, smoking, all the atherosclerotic risk factors, because it's a disease of atherosclerosis. Different from aortic dissection. Aortic dissection is really much more purely a disease of hypertension, or in young people, of collagen vascular disease. But be afraid of risk factors. Don't use risk factors to rule out a disease. It can help you to have a higher index of suspicion, but ruling out something because the person doesn't have classic risk factors can get you into trouble. Having said that, in general, the person who's going to come in with an abdominal aortic aneurysm as a cause of their back pain is generally an older smoker who has atherosclerotic disease, right?
It's not the first thing that pops to your mind when you think back pain, but if you have someone who's 60 years old with a history of longstanding hypertension, for example, and their back pain is relatively new in onset, you've got to think about that first.
Okay, and then is there a classic history for AAA that you know of?
Like syncope?
Now, the things that I look for on history that suggest AAA are, number one, those huge risk factors, which are hypertension and age. Those are the biggies. And if they have any ripping component to it, if it's anything that seems to go to the abdomen or come from the abdomen or the pelvis, right? Because that's where the vessels are, the aorta and the branches go into the pelvis. If there's any question that they were lightheaded or that there was syncope or that there's any element of shockiness whatsoever, you've got to think quickly. And basically, anything that you do with that patient at that point in time, other than immediately summon help, could be too late. And so we don't want that patient waiting. We don't want them going to CAT scan. Basically, in the ER these days, it's becoming very, very common, especially in centers with ultrasound, to get the ultrasound on their belly right up front, right within the triage process, even if they're older and they're having a new onset of pain that you think could be a AAA. So that's usually not your lower back pain patients, but it has to be mentioned at the beginning, because if you don't think about that up front in an older hypertensive, you're going to, you know, they could arrest while they're in the ER.
I'll add a couple of things to that. I would add flank pain. They say it's back pain, but it's actually flank pain. For some reason, dominant aortic aneurysms, as they're rupturing, often will complain of flank pain, so it'll also look like renal colic.
Now, there is something called the 3-centimeter rule, which is when you're doing an ultrasound, which is really something that's in all of our capabilities. It's really not. It's one of the easiest things you can do, to put an ultrasound probe on and look at the aorta. If there's any symptoms that could be referred to that aorta, for example, new onset back pain in an elderly hypertensive, and you do a little scan that shows you've got a 3.5-centimeter aorta, that's big enough to call it a 3-alarm fire. You got to get the vascular surgeon immediately. Anything above 3 with symptoms is considered symptomatic AAA.
So your abdominal aorta is supposed to be around 2 centimeters, is that right?
Yeah, anything less than 2 would be normal. And
so over 3 plus symptoms makes me worry.
Worry about symptomatic AAA, exactly.
Okay, so we talked a little bit about AAA. So let's hit the elephant in the room, which is spinal cord compression and cauda equina syndrome.
Spinal cord compression and cauda equina.
I kind of lump these in together, right? And it's, in any way, it's, in one way or another, there's a mass effect
exactly.
on the spinal cord or the cauda equina. And do you remember what the cauda equina is from your anatomy classes?
It's all of the lumbosacral nerve roots that are coming off the spinal cord but haven't exited the vertebral column yet.
Next up, Mel, you mentioned cauda equina and spinal cord compression. And you know what? To be honest, it doesn't make a hell of a difference between the two of them. They're both really bad. They're both emergent neurosurgical consults, and they need decompression, okay? So the only difference is that the cauda equina syndrome, the classic one, is a lower motor neuron thing. It's good for exam questions. And the spinal cord compression, anything above that, before the spinal cord ends, is an upper motor neuron lesion, but they both result in paralysis, the bowel and bladder don't work, that same clinical picture. So when do you worry about cauda equina? Obviously, if they come in and they paralyze legs and they're pooping themselves and they can't pee, that's, you know, it's probably...
Oh, you mean if they're a baby?
It's too late. Yeah, exactly. No. They can pee. They can pee. That's the difference. They can always pee. But the thing is that that's too late, right, when that happens. So the whole key here is how to pick it up before that happens. And you really just have to think about a few things. The sciatica that we talk about. Sciatica is that electrical sensation that you get down your leg that often radiates down one of those dermatomes, right? Because you got a pinched nerve on one side or other of the spinal cord. When you have that symptom down both legs, okay, that's when you start to get concerned. When you start to see, because that implies that it's not just a nerve root on one side or the other, right? It implies that it's something central, like the stuff in the middle, the cauda equina, the stuff that causes that irreversible damage.
So actually, maybe you need to back up. What is cauda equina? What is this special part of the spinal cord you're talking about?
The spinal cord ends at about L1, L2 in a bunch of fibers that look like a tail of a horse. And that's why it's called cauda equina. And those are basically the nerve roots that go on to supply the motor to the legs and the bowel and bladder. Basically everything from L4, L5, all the way down to S2, 3, and 4. That whole range in there is supplied by that horse's tail. And so if you have a symptom that has to do with a compression of one of those individual nerves on one side or the other, that's usually pretty a benign thing. People operate on that. It's when there's central compression in that horse's tail or in the cord itself, that's a 3-alarm fire. So that's why bilateral symptoms are so key. That tells us, hey, maybe there is something central. And that's when I start to get really worried. Now, if you add on to that any motor deficit, okay, especially if it's progressive, you know, it's not like the patient comes in and said they had their foot drop and it's been for 6 weeks or 6 months. That's one thing. But any progression in a motor deficit, especially in the context of bilateral symptoms, is a critical red flag. And then the last thing is the bowel and bladder symptoms, which we've mentioned. And again, if they're pooping themselves and they can't pee, it's obvious, but it's incumbent on you to actually check those things, especially if they're having actual serious sounding symptoms and motor findings. You better check those things. And that's done through the rectal exam for the bowel or the reflexes around the anus. And by taking a look at the bladder, either with an ultrasound to make sure they've completely emptied it, that they completely empty, or by putting it, if you don't have an ultrasound, by putting in a catheter and making sure that there's less than, say, 100, 150 cc's of urine in there.
So you didn't say it explicitly. You're saying looking for the post-void residual. A normal bladder, normally innervated in a normal person, when you pee, will empty and have less than, what's the number, 100 mils?
Yeah, 100 to 150. That's about the range you're going to hear.
And you can do that. You can say, Mr. Smith, go wee all the way out. And you can look with ultrasound and using, you know, some numbers, you can look on ultrasound and say, yes, the bladder is very empty. It's functioning normal. Or you can do it with then putting a Foley catheter in and finding how much is left. It's a pretty sensitive finding for those cord problems, but it's not in the older guys particularly specific because that post-void residual can go up because you have prostate issues.
Prostate issues, exactly. And so the prostate's the main confounder. That's right.
So I want to try and summarize this again. So I've got this person with back pain and they've got neurological findings. It sounds to me like you're defining two types of neurological findings. You're defining neurological findings that don't scare you, those that are unilateral, they're down one leg, they're lightning-like pain. They could even have neurological motor findings, but they're not progressive. They've got some weakness, but it's unilateral and it's not getting worse and it's been there for a while. So that's a classically is from a disc which is pushing out on a nerve exiting the spinal cord. And that's classic sciatica. That's a classic radiculopathy. But if you've got bilateral symptoms, if you've got symptoms that involve the bladder, which therefore suggests that it's bilateral, if you've got symptoms that suggest that go to the bowel, I'm pooping myself.
That's right. You made a good point there, Mel, which is that when you say that the bowel and bladder implies bilateral, it does, because those would imply a central compression. That's exactly right.
So anything that's bilateral is bad, and bowel symptoms, bladder symptoms are bilateral, that's bad. And what do we do with these? If we think, because a lot of these can occur because of cancer or a fracture or anything that physically is pushing on that spinal cord or physically pushing on the end of that spinal cord and all those nerves that are coming out. There can even be the very rare disc. So most discs, when they herniate, they go to the side and they give you the radiculopathy. They hit that spinal nerve. But about 1 in 1,000 disc herniations can go directly back and hit your spinal cord.
Exactly right. The central herniation. That's right.
So what do we do with these people? Back pain, bad neurological findings, I'm scared. How do I make the diagnosis? Yes, Mel, I'm right. And then what do I do with them?
Okay, so this is a 3-alarm fire because basically what we know about this condition is that the deficit that they go into their operation with is what they're probably going to leave with. Meaning mm-hmm. that if it's gone too far and they don't get to the operating room before they're completely paralyzed and they've got no bowel and bladder function, it's almost too late. And so you really want to get the neurosurgeon on the blower right away. They're going to ask you to give a big whack of Decadron. They're going to ask you to give 10 milligrams or something like that intravenously of Decadron. That's something that might help a little bit with the swelling and the pressure effect. And you need an MRI. I mean, they're not going to operate without imaging in 2015. They need that image. And so you're going to cue that up right away. That's basically it. It's fast MRI, neurosurgery, Decadron.
So I've got this person. They've got back pain. I believe that they have a spinal cord syndrome, a corticoid syndrome. I'm going to give steroids to reduce swelling. I'm going to get an MRI to confirm the diagnosis. I'm going to call a neurosurgeon. And time is function. The longer I wait,
exactly
the
right.
worse they get.
Exactly right. Some other things that you might want to pay a little bit of attention to, if that patient's on Coumadin, for example, you know, they're going to have to be reversed for surgery. And so please think about that. With so many people on anticoagulation, that's something that's going to be a high priority as they move towards an operating room.
One of the other things we need to talk about, and I'm not sure we said it explicitly, is you look at rectal tone, you look at post-void residual, and you look at saddle anesthesia, that part of the butt that lies on the saddle. If there's reduced sensation there, again, you've got to be thinking about corticoid syndrome, spinal cord syndromes.
Part 2.
So we talked about AAA, we talked about cord compression syndromes. All right, Jess, you there with the residents? Give us another cause of back pain that we need to talk about.
Okay, so the other sort of broad category for bad back pain is infection.
Infection.
And you guys just alluded to the fact that catechina or any spinal cord compression can be caused by an epidural abscess, and that's infectious. But there's other things, other types of infections that can cause very serious back pain. And I think you said one earlier, John.
Osteomyelitis.
Osteomyelitis, yeah, that's right. So that's a bone infection of the vertebrae, right? So that's also potentially very, very bad cause of back pain.
Yeah, and then you could pretty much just pick your tissue in the back and then put itis next to it. You know, like, I mean, yeah, you have discitis, you brought up osteomyelitis. The key is there's an infection somewhere back there.
This is where I'm going to really impress you, Mel. I'm going to try to basically lump together at least four, maybe five or six different diagnoses into one category, infection. So we're talking about things like a psoas abscess, okay? That could cause back pain, right? And it's serious, really serious, kills people. Spinal epidural abscess.
Bad.
You're familiar with the concept, right? Not good, okay? Paralyzes people. Osteomyelitis back there. You can get an infection in the bone. And discitis, which, by the way, is not, you know, you've got a little discitis, like it's like tennis elbow. Discitis means severe bacterial infection in the spine that can paralyze you and kill you. That's what discitis is. So all of those things, to me, are in one basket. They're infection. They got the same risks. They have the same test. They have the same management.
So the people who get these infections of their spinal cord surrounding structures, people who are at risk for infection, and we know this, it's the same in every disease. This is the IV drug user is injecting themselves with Staph aureus and already has a bad immune system. They're going to get infections in their spinal cord. The immune compromised person in general, and the classic big ones in this country and most of the Western world, is diabetes. Those people on chronic steroids. But also one that's not quite as obvious as somebody with an indwelling catheter. This tends to set up bacteremia and they can get seeding to their spinal cord or to their paraspinal cord structures. So it turns out that the blood supply to the back, to the bones of the back, to the discs of the back is not very good. If you put a Foley catheter in, for example, you can get a little bacteremia. It can seed there. We can't fight these infections very well. But these are generally predictable patients. These are the people that are at risk for these things. So, Swad, what do you look for on history and exam to pull this group out? I'm assuming this is a pretty rare cause of back pain. So what am I going to ask in the history and the physical exam to pull out that group of patients that potentially have an infection as a cause of their back pain?
Okay, well, Mel, I'm going to give you some opinions now so people actually really can remember what we're talking about. Because we've seen a lot of this where we work. And I want to say, I want to put it out there that the traditional red flags that we always talk about when we talk about a lower back pain workup, night pain, pain at rest, sudden onset, they're always emphasizing sudden onset could be serious, not relieved by rest. How many times, Mel, have you heard each and every one of those complaints from a patient that you discharge with a diagnosis of mechanical back pain?
17.8 times.
I mean, so these things are, you know, yeah. I mean, I don't like it when patients tell me, oh, it hurts at night and I can't sleep. But most of those patients will still be mechanical back pain. And so I don't ignore those things, but I don't think they're as helpful as we've been kind of led to believe. There's more important things. The more important things are what you just talked about. So if they are an IV drug user and they have a new onset of back pain, I'm going to be like a bulldog on that diagnosis. I really want to make sure that's not there, regardless of whether they have the rest pain and the night pain. If they come into the ER with back pain and that's their background, I'm really concerned. Now, remember, when it gets to the physical exam, that's not really great either. But if you have a fever, you know, you got a fever. If you're an at-risk patient with a fever and new onset back pain especially, they're going to get worked up, right? So that's that. But don't rely on it to be there.
Well, let me just say before you go there, and about 2% of emergency department patients have a fever sort of because they've got a viral syndrome. So if you've got back pain and fever, some people have done these analyses where they say it's still more likely that you've just got a cold and back pain, but you have to just not, you cannot ignore that.
No, you can't ignore it. And that's exactly how I'd put it, Mel. If there's a fever with a new onset of back pain and there isn't an obvious other cause for the fever, you really have to work them up.
Fever plus back pain is a four-alarm fire. You have to have the default position. This is bad until proven otherwise. When you're examining a patient, one of the red flags we look for is midline tenderness, because midline tenderness suggests a bad cause of the back pain. It suggests that it's in the bone. And if it's in the bone, that's bad.
Absolutely. And I do really take note of that if they say, hey, doc, it's right here. And they point right over the midline of the bone. But keep in mind, Mel, that a lot of these bad things that we are talking about, the cancers, the infections, it doesn't have to be that way. They might just come in with a new presentation of back pain that's very unilateral. But that doesn't mean that there's not a bad malignancy or infection that's there. Because think about it, Mel, it doesn't have to be central to be bad. In the back, right? If it's an infection or it's a cancer, it doesn't have to be like that central disc. It can be off to the side. We still need to know it's there. And so that's the critical difference between the sciatica, cauda equina line of thinking and the could it be a cancer or an infection line of thinking.
But at the same time, though, if you're tapping down their back, tap, tap, tap down the midline of their back, and you get to a vertebra and you tap on it and they jump off the bed, that makes me very anxious.
Exactly.
So what have we left out so far? We've talked about abdominal aneurysm, old person hypertensive, smoke, got it. We've talked about cord compression syndromes as a group, anything that makes you have a cord compression syndrome, cord or equine syndrome, bad. We've now just talked about infections as a group. That's bad. The immune suppressed patient, the person with a fever. What tests do I do if I'm worried about infections in the back? Okay, so Stuart, we did a good physical. We really, really teased out these risk factors. This is one of the few areas in medicine where risk factors really help us. And we did our physical exam. Are there any tests, lab tests specifically, serum tests that I can do that's going to help sort the wheat from the chaff?
The one test that is going to be most helpful here is an ESR, an erythrocyte sedimentation rate. And that's because it does sort of separate the badness out from the rest of the crowd. It's not 100%. So if I come in to you, Mel, and I'm saying, look, I've been shooting drugs and I have a fever and it hurts right here. Okay, MRI, it's a no-brainer. But if I'm like, well, you know, I used to use drugs 20 years ago. I swear I've been clean since then. There's no fever. And it sounds like it probably is related to work. You know what I mean? It doesn't really sound high prob, but you want to send a test. It's a screen. ESR is your test. It's about 97% sensitive or so. And so in a low prob patient, it's a reasonable screen.
Right. So I'm worried about this patient a little bit that it could be infection, but I don't want to MRI them. Yeah, I can see how you could use ESR. I'm not a big ESR fan, but you said it the right way. So the IV drug user comes in, yeah, says, yeah, I shoot every day. I got back pain. I don't care what the ESR is. It doesn't matter. I'm going straight to MRI. It doesn't matter. But in that situation where, well, this is an older patient and they've got a little diabetes, but I really don't see anything else here that suggests it's bad, and we'll send off an ESR and it's normal. It's just adding up to lower and lower probability. So yeah, I think you can use ESR logically in that manner. You said the other thing though, where like it's an IV drug user, they got a fever and MRI is 3 hours away. I'm culturing them, I'm giving them antibiotics, and then I'm waiting for the MRI.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And you know what, Mel? This is assuming that there's no neuro features. If this same patient that has new onset back pain has any neuro findings along with that risk factor suspicion, again, I'm also going straight to MRI with those people as well.
So I'm worried about infection as a cause of back pain. And what we're going to do is, one, we're going to get cultures. Two, we're going to get antimicrobials with great staphylococcal coverage. We're going to get the MRI and we're going to call a surgeon.
Awesome.
All right, so you have told me now about some bad causes of back pain. You've talked about AAA. You've talked about cord or equine and spinal cord syndromes. You've talked about infections.
The other two sort of broad categories that we talked about are cancer and fractures. So let's talk about cancer.
Cancer.
Just like you learned in med school or PA school, what is the really common cancer for men that tends to go to the spine?
Prostate.
Yeah,
prostate
right.
Cancer.
Someone has a history of prostate cancer, that should really increase your level of suspicion. And then, Andres, do you know in women what the most common cancer is? Just overall, and also goes to the spine.
Breast cancer?
Yeah, that's right.
Said it with confidence. You like that? Yes.
Let's talk about cancer. Now, I've got my own spiel here, which is cancer is bad. Cancer kills lots of people, but cancer kills people over time. I don't need to diagnose cancer today, Stuart, in the emergency department. So what's the standard of care here? Do I really need to worry about this, or is it only when cancer is causing an acute problem that I need to worry about it?
You said it perfectly. You said it absolutely perfectly. It's only when cancer is causing an acute emergency that it's required that we diagnose it and get it on its way to treatment, which usually means, in this case, surgery or radiation therapy, that type of thing. But the thing is that, Mel, if they come in with, again, a new onset of back pain, and they've got breast cancer, they've got prostate cancer. And let's focus on those two for the time being, because those are the number one causes in males and females that go to bone, right? You've got to really be careful. And so, absolutely, if their neurological exam is normal and they don't have any of these other additional issues that we're talking about, sure, they can go back to their primary. They can have a bone scan. They can get imaging as an outpatient. Absolutely. But I have a feeling that people sometimes miss the subtle presentations that ought to be picked up. And what I mean by that is that they don't have gross weakness. They're still walking. If there is a subtle compression, you might notice that they have a sensory level, that they start to feel sensation all of a sudden at the nipple level or T10 level or the lumbar one level, all of a sudden the sensation has dropped off. And that's just a very quick thing you can do. So not only does a neuro exam have to be normal, but it should be a more complete neuro exam in these patients, including that sensory level testing.
I like what you're saying about cancer. Cancer is a bad cause of back pain. Sometimes it doesn't have to be diagnosed today, but it often does, because the reason they came today is because there's an acute problem, right? And now they've got cancer. Okay, so it's an issue. So who has cancer as a cause of back pain? People with a history of cancer is the biggest one. People who have been losing weight, people who have the cancer syndrome, night sweats, fevers. These are the people I worry about with cancer as a cause of back pain. And although not all patients with cancer and back pain need to be admitted, I think your point's very important. If you have cancer and you present with back pain, most of the time it's because you're presenting with an acute problem. The pain is really bad and it's new. So we talked about abdominal aortic aneurysm as a cause of back pain. We talked about cauda equina syndrome and spinal cord syndromes. We talked about infections. We talked about cancer. But what are we missing?
Fracture.
Fracture.
We didn't talk about simple fractures. Obviously, again, you think about that if it's someone who was in a big accident. I mean, that's really not the kind of patient that we're generally talking about here. That's sort of in a separate part of my mind anyway, the trauma presentation. But what about all the older people that have osteoporosis and they can get fractures just by living, like you were saying earlier? I was going to ask you, when do you, in a case where there's none of these other obvious red flags, okay, there's not the fever, we're not going down the infection route or the cauda equina route, when do you image?
Yeah, so Stuart, who do I image? Who doesn't have red flags? Who comes in with back pain? I think the answer is pretty simple. Old people. It depends on how you define old people. Generally, the definition is of old is somebody who's 5 years older than you. I'm 50 years old, so anybody over the age of 55.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the thing, is that there's a million guidelines out there, Mel. There's the British, and there's American, there's Canadian, and they're all trying to reduce the utilization of x-rays for patients that don't have any of these obvious red flags. And basically, they say, most of them, that if they're over 50, 55, you should image them. But I have a soft interpretation of that. I mean, if they're healthy, you know, vigorous 70-year-old that doesn't have osteoporosis, I don't think you have to image them unless, again, there's a trauma, there's a cancer risk factor. I don't think it's an absolute. And so I'm not sure if these guidelines are really bringing down the number of films or if they're just actually a little too liberal.
What Stuart is referencing there is the work of a number of different groups trying to bring down the number of screening back films that are being done here in the US and across the world. In fact, one of the first research projects I worked on when I first immigrated to the US was the AHRQ, which was on back pain. Because back then, 25 years ago, everybody with back pain would get an x-ray as a screen, and people getting x-rays even as an outpatient who are asymptomatic, who were firefighters, for example. And it was a big, giant waste of time with lots of radiation and pretty much useless. So the first thing to say is, if you're doing back x-rays kind of as a screen to rule out badness, that's really bad, it's a lot of radiation, and it's been shown over and over again to be basically useless. You do back films when you're worried about fractures. That's about the only time. If you're worried about cancer, you need a CT or an MRI. If you're worried about infection, you need a CT or an MRI. If you're worried about abdominal aortic aneurysm, you need an ultrasound or a CT. So back films themselves have very limited utility. Yeah, you can use them as a screen. Grandma fell over, she's got a bit of back pain, I'll do an x-ray, I'll see if everything looks right. If not, I'll go on and do a CT scan. That's not unreasonable. But if you're in the habit of or work in a place that sort of you've got back pain, come to the emergency department, we'll get some screening films for you. That is a huge waste of time and a lot of radiation. Don't do that. So there are guidelines out there, and they basically are based on age. If you're very young, if you're very old, if you've got osteoporosis, if you've got risk factors for osteoporosis like steroids, maybe plain films of your back are a reasonable thing to do. But in general, in the patient who doesn't have a good reason for a fracture or something else that plain films are reasonably good at, don't get them. Get the test that you really need or get no tests.
You know, Mel, I wanted to mention a few specific things about some special populations. The first thing is pediatrics. You know, it's not typical to have a toddler come in and say, oh, you know, it's hurting in my back and, you know, I've had this before. I mean, it's a whole different kettle of fish in a kid, basically.
And frankly, we're not going to cover it on this C3, but we are going to get back to it later because pediatricians are really divided, actually, about an approach to back pain in kids and also whether it's a serious thing or not. Some saying that, you know, it's really common, so therefore it's not that big a deal. You look for red flags just like you do in adults. And others say, no, kids with back pain are a subset of patients that are really high risk. So I don't know. We're going to ask them later.
Now, here's an interesting one, Mel, that is a special population that is helpful to know. Athletes. In athletes that are doing lots of bending, backward, forward, gymnastics would be a classic example. They can come with a back pain presentation, and they otherwise look really healthy. And when you do the plane films, you see that they've actually got a slippage of the vertebra one on top of
spondylolisthesis.
Yes, spondylolisthesis.
Yeah, back pain in athletes, and it's particularly athletes in hyperextension sports. And the classic hyperextension sports are gymnastics and golf, where you're constantly hyperextending. In a young athlete, they can get the Scotty dog, the pars, intra-articularis fractures. They get spondylolisthesis. One vertebra starts to slip over the other, and they might need surgery.
And they often don't. But you got to get other people involved to help sort that out at that point.
In the elderly, I'm very liberal with taking a look at that back with some x-rays. They can develop unstable fractures with very minor injuries.
Now, Mel, I usually start with plain film still in this population. Do you go straight to CT?
Some people do. I think a screening plain film is a good thing to do. It depends on your level of risk. I'm not that worried. Maybe I'm just going to screen them because they're elderly and they got a little bit of back pain and I just want to make sure. But if I see on the plain film something that's abnormal, I go to CT scan because the plain films often significantly underrepresent the amount of damage. So if they're normal, I'm not worried, I stop. But if, for example, grandma just had a bit of a slip and fall, doesn't seem like much, but I see that she's got a little bit of a crush fracture or two on the plain film that doesn't look unstable, I'll CT it because I can't tell you how many times that when you scan them, there are retropulse fragments and badness everywhere. So if it's abnormal, I will follow up with a CT scan.
Part 3.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, let's go back with Dr. Mason and her intrepid residents and examine the patient and follow this case through to its sort of logical endpoint. And then we're going to come back and talk about those patients who don't have serious causes of back pain, what you do for them. But let's get back to our real patient and our real scenario, which has, of course, been modified and edited to protect the innocent.
Okay, so we're going to go examine our patient together now.
Okay.
And then we'll talk through the exam findings.
Okay.
Okay, so you guys went and did the physical exam. What did you find?
So this patient, first of all, her vital signs, she's got a temperature of 99, and that's oral. Neurologically, she's grossly intact in the lower extremities. Like, she's got 5 out of 5 strength, both the right and the left lower extremity. There is, and her reflexes were 2+, both sides. She has midline tenderness at L1, and she doesn't have any saddle anesthesia.
Good. And then did you guys do a rectal exam?
Yeah, and she had good rectal tone.
Did you guys do a post-void residual ultrasound?
Jacqueline?
Yeah, she had 180 mils. She is able to urinate on her own, but she does have retention.
Okay, yeah, I think we would call that retention. All right, so we need to pursue this, right? We have this borderline, you know, she's not technically febrile on an oral temp. Focal, pretty tender, right over L1.
That's what I wanted to get at. So she's like really tender mid, and so she's definitely L1 or maybe even higher, right?
And of course, in the history, remember, she had that episode of urinary incontinence. So she's young, she's got point tenderness over L1. She has what sounds like a history of urinary incontinence and some low-grade fevers.
All right, so we talked about imaging a little bit. What do you want to order?
So I think the decision here probably is CT versus MRI. So, I mean, just to kind of recap her, she doesn't have any past medical history, she's not an IV drug user, and she's had no recent illnesses. Having that said, the fact that she's really tender at L1, and the fact that she has been had a subjective fever,
right.
and we didn't get a core temp on her, but...
But it doesn't matter, right? I mean, we're going to work her up.
The only decision there for me would be CT versus MRI, and
you're her doc. What are you going to order?
Logistically, I'm probably going to get the CT, because the CT is a lot faster,
mm-hmm.
and I can at least start to get some type of findings quicker.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, though, an MRI would be suited for her.
I don't know if this is a fair question, but you're going to do a CT. Are you going to choose, you know, T10 through L5? Like, what segment?
Yeah, I'm going to scan her from... I'm going to do a TNL spine on her,
mm-hmm.
especially because she's tender at L1.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they generally will get, you know, T12. I mean, you can work with your radiologist and have them scan, you know, like particular vertebrae, but I think at this point, you just get the TNL and with contrast and be done with it.
Okay. I think that this particular patient, no past medical history, no recent injuries. This isn't something where a CT is going to give us all of the information that we need. Yes, it's possible she has a fracture there, but it's also possible that there's some soft tissue injury, including the spinal cord, that we're just not going to pick up on a CT. And with the information we have right now, this very young patient, previously healthy, an MRI is probably the best test for her.
So we often have to do this, weigh up the logistics of getting a test that's good but not best versus a test that's really hard to get, which might be the gold standard. So in this case, they actually got an MRI.
Hi, we've got a 30-year-old patient right now with L1 tenderness, previously healthy, and she's just got these new symptoms. Okay.
Tell her you want to bump her to the front of the line.
Look, I really could use your help here bumping this patient to the front of the line. You can do that? Okay, great. Hey, listen, guys, we can get her in right now. Yeah, I'll tell the nurse. I'll be right back.
Well, unfortunately, that's all we have time for. You'll have to wait till next month to find out the results. No, only kidding. Here they are.
All right, Dr. Anaya, what you got for me?
So the CRP is 22 and the ESR is 75.
Okay.
And the
that's concerning.
The MRI came back with osteo at L1.
So osteomyelitis?
Yes.
So this would be a medical emergency, right? We want to get on this quickly. What are the next steps? What are the next steps that we need to take?
So we're going to draw blood cultures if they haven't already been drawn, and then we're going to start antibiotics right away. We'll start around vanc and rocephin or cefepime, and then our next phone call is going to be to here would be neurosurgery.
Okay.
Yeah, we've got a patient here, and her MRI just came back positive for osteomyelitis at L1. Okay, you'll come see the patient. Great.
Which part of this do you think is fake? That's correct. Telling a neurosurgeon that you've got a patient down here with a disease that they really need to see and have them actually agree to come down immediately. That, obviously, never happens. You've got to fight. So the follow-up in this real case, which has, of course, been modified to protect various people, is that the patient indeed had osteomyelitis, was admitted to the hospital, got antimicrobials. The decision to do surgery was, everything's stable. Let's just give antimicrobials and see if we can beat it that way. There was no cord compression. There was no abscess formation. And unfortunately, the patient left against medical advice a number of days later. It's a pretty classic case. So what we did is that we had a real patient encounter. We went through the bad causes of back pain. We talked about abdominal aortic aneurysm. We talked about infections. We talked about cord compression syndromes. We talked about fractures. We talked about cancers. We talked about some specific select subgroups of patients. But the vast majority of patients that you see with back pain just have mechanical back pain. It's nothing serious that needs to go to the OR or have steroids or have antimicrobials. It's serious to them because it's affecting their daily life. So what do we do for the vast majority of patients who we're not concerned? Or if we are concerned we've ruled out anything bad, what do we do for those patients?
Okay, so let's bring this puppy home, Mel. So we've really, I think, fleshed out the important red flags, ruling out the badness. So now let's talk about the vast majority of these patients who you're going to send home. What's your approach, Mel?
When I first came from my country to
back
your
country,
back in
the 60s,
I did a lot of stuff on the AHCPR guidelines for back pain. My summary was this: provide analgesia and go back to your normal activities. Has anything changed in the last 20 years since I came to this fine country? Actually, 25 years ago since I came to this fine country.
In a word, Mel, no, nothing has changed. And all the evidence continues to point to that critical, critical element, which is early activity. That's the only thing that consistently shows a better outcome. And so in a very positive, very encouraging way, I tell them this gets better faster when we stay active. Even though it's a struggle, sometimes we stay active. I often tell them about how common it is. I tell them sometimes even my own experiences of having trouble with my spine. And that I think is reasonable to do because this is a common problem. And I think that helps people to contextualize. And in terms of the analgesia, I think we're all very careful these days about not loading these people up on opioids. It's really something that we have to be careful about.
I agree. I do that normalization thing, which is I have back pain. It's a problem. I also tell them it's often a recurrent problem. This is a real issue. But I try and give them some power back. Here's the best thing you can do for you. It doesn't always work, but the best thing you can do is be as lean as possible, be as fit as possible, exercise. Don't get crazy, but exercise as much as you can. And if you do those things, you're doing the best possible thing for your back. And it's a nice way to get some of those people who are a little tubby to go and exercise. So I really try and put it in a healthy lifestyle kind of thing. Go for a walk for 30 minutes to an hour a day. Do some sit-ups every day. Be as lean as you can. And that's the best thing you can do to prevent the next episode of this back pain.
You know what, Mel? Even though we can't really offer them much more now, than we could, let's say, 20 years ago in terms of what really works for back pain. I find that in my own experience, just having that consistent, fresh approach, as we were talking about, being really open with them, trying to get them on board, spending a little extra time because I know that there's no red flags there and that's the only thing that'll probably make a difference is my attitude. I've gotten a little bit better at it and it's really an art, but it's a matter, like you say, of getting them on board, showing understanding, showing empathy. I think that makes things just go so much better on the back end.
I will agree. I've noticed your attitude has gotten a lot better over the last few years.
One other thing we should talk about is the use of muscle relaxants. They are very commonly prescribed, things like Flexeril and all this kind of stuff, you know, benzos. But there is essentially no evidence that they help. If you look at outcomes, do patients get back to work faster and that kind of stuff, it makes people very sedated and it probably doesn't help. They're still in really common use, but if you look at it from a purely evidence-based point of view, it's almost impossible to show that these things have much good. If you're going to use them, a lot of people say then just use benzos because they're safe, and some of these other drugs that are often sort of serotonin or tricyclic-like are actually quite dangerous. So if you think the person needs some relief, even though it's very unclear if it provides much relief in terms of muscle spasm, at least do it cheaply and do it with a safe benzo.
Summary.
So let me try and summarize again in a slightly different way. Patient comes in with back pain. The vast majority of people with back pain don't have anything. They just need some analgesia, go back to their normal activities. A few patients that you see are going to have something bad. A bad screening test, though, is to do plain films. Really a bad screening test. Good history and physical is all you need to do. If you think about the bad diseases, then you can think about the red flags. So if you're worried about, as a category, cancer, what predicts cancer? Older age. And maybe younger age too, actually, for leukemias and stuff. If they're having fevers, night sweats, chills, sort of those B symptoms, that's suggested. Perhaps the biggest thing is that they have a history of cancer and now they have back pain. Ask those questions. If you're worried about an abdominal aortic aneurysm, it's mostly about the physical exam. Yes, if they're older, if they have vascular disease in the periphery, and then put an ultrasound on their belly and make sure they don't have a AAA. That will rule out that disease. If you're worried about fractures, who gets fractures? Somebody who's young with a hyperextension sport like gymnastics or golf, or anybody that's old, with or without trauma a lot of the time, just sneezing. Or anybody that is at risk for osteoporosis, so they're on steroids or they have known osteoporosis. And who else gets fractures? Well, people who have significant trauma. The younger person who's in significant trauma or recently had it, who now has back pain, is at risk for fractures, right? And then infections. What questions do we ask to make the probability of infection higher? Do you have a fever? Obviously. Are you immune suppressed? Steroids, diabetes, HIV? Ask those specific questions. And if they're negative to all of those, it's much less likely. And then the big one, do they have a cord syndrome? Not a lateral syndrome, not a I've got some shooting pain down my leg syndrome. That's a pain, but that's not what we're worried about. We're worried about pressure on the cord itself. And the signs and symptoms that suggest there's pressure on the cord itself, which can occur from a whole bunch of things. It can occur from cancer. It can occur from fractures. It can occur from infections. It can occur from a central disc prolapse that's gone straight back and bashed into your spinal cord. The things that you really have to ask about there, obviously, is bladder and bowel symptoms. Are you pooping on yourself? Are you peeing on yourself? A post-void residual. And kind of along with that, we think about people with rapidly progressive neurological symptoms. So I've got pain down my leg one day, then I've got pain down my leg the next day, then I've got a little numbness around my belly. That's rapidly progressive. That makes you worry as well. And then thoracic pain itself is kind of we're not sure where to categorize those people, but it's a bit more concerning. The spinal cord is a little bit narrower there. And the pediatric subgroup we'll talk about at a separate time. And obviously as a group, as a catch-all to catch a lot of people with bad causes of back pain, as always, be afraid of the elderly patient. But again, I have to say it 100 times, don't screen with plain films. If you're worried about cancer, the best test is MRI or CT. If you're worried about infection, the best test is not a CBC or even an ESR. The best test is a CT scan or MRI over the part that hurts. If you're worried about fractures, okay, you might be able to screen with a plain film, but if you see a fracture or if you have a high index of suspicion, CT scanning or MRI is better. If you're worried about a vascular problem, abdominal aortic aneurysm, which is causing this back pain, an ultrasound or a CT scan is the right test. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, his name was Stuart Swadron. Her name was Dr. Jess Mason. She was with John and Andreas. And now let's finish off with a personal story of back pain. And it's pretty amazing. I'd never really seen a case like this before. At least I'd never diagnosed one.
But remember, as you're listening to this case from one of the residents, that this is really rare, but it happens.
No, I've had personal experience with it. It sounds funny, but yeah, it's like one of those things that, like, when it happens to you, it's a huge thing. It's not on pretty much anybody's differential, but it's a game changer if you miss it.
And okay, so let's go down this tangent for a second. So this happened to you?
Yeah, I was it was during first year medical school. And I weightlift. I was working out with one of my classmates, my roommate, and we had gotten home from the gym, went home, went to bed. The workout wasn't anything in particular, you know, stressful. We were doing deadlifts, but they were light. Went home, went to bed, and I woke up out of a dead sleep, in 10 out of 10 pain. It was non-radiating. I had this palpable mass in my right lower back. I was stiff as a board. I could not bend at the hips at all. I somehow drove myself like a madman to the ED, and I was halfway through first year med school, and we had just covered compartment syndrome, and I rushed in there and go, I have compartment syndrome. And after the roar of laughter, they gave me pain meds and muscle relaxers. And I left pretty much in the same state that I arrived in, except a little more, the pain was dulled. And I spent the next 6 weeks in bed. I could not literally get out of bed, literally. It got to the point where my college advisor called me at home and said, why haven't you been in class? And got me in for an emergent MRI. And before I could leave the MRI center, they said, we need you to go directly to the ortho department. You have acute paraspinal compartment syndrome. And you may need emergent surgery. So I got there. They evaluated it and felt that it was too late. They would have tried to open up the compartment then. They would have put me at risk for all kinds of other infections, including just shock from just opening up the compartment 6 weeks later. So I had to just kind of tough it out, and it pretty much had a consequence of I no longer can weightlift like I used to, which is my thing. And there was another case report just like mine, where it was which seems to be happening more and more, between 30 and 40 active males that are either skiing, lifting, whatnot, and they end up pretty much with the same symptoms. It's non-radiating, worse pain. The symptoms don't get better with pain medications. And this other guy, same presentation, they held him and he went to the OR, ended up getting a fasciotomy, and was back doing his regular activities within 8 weeks.
Wow.
Mine's 6 years later, and it's a pretty serious chronic condition.
Wow. How long were you out for?
So the rest of first year was rough. Pretty much did med school from home.
Mm-hmm.
And which just made it if you can just imagine, all the harder.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention all the pain meds and everything else just to be able to walk. So I'd say, it took me a couple of years to be able to be back at the gym. But even now I'm better, but it's taken quite a bit of work.
So back pain is something that you're really aware of when you work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is definitely something I'm hyper aware about.
Yeah.
So if the symptoms don't get better for me, when their pain doesn't have to be better by the time that they're discharged,
mm-hmm.
but there has to be an improvement that correlates with the treatment that I gave them.
Yeah.
So if I gave them, pain medications and their pain gets a lot better,
mm-hmm.
they're able to move,
mm-hmm.
then that tells me that the reason why they're here was really secondary to pain and not mm-hmm. some other physical limitation.
Right.
As opposed to if I give them muscle relaxers and they still can't bend, or they still can't do anything, then your index of suspicion has to be high and you're not done yet.
Pretty intense story, huh? And thanks, Andreas, for sharing that with us. So we might add that to another potentially very serious cause of back pain in young people, which is that person who's exercising, who's developed a compartment syndrome. And I've said this in other areas, but in any patient where there's pain out of proportion to findings, it's usually something bad. And this is another example of that. Compartment syndrome doesn't look like too much, but the person's in a lot of pain. Think about compartment syndromes, and I don't think I've ever seen this, or at least I've never diagnosed this, but your sort of paraspinous muscles are huge. They're in compartments, and of course you can get a compartment syndrome there.
So thanks for that story. Thanks for listening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. And we'll talk to you more on the C3 Project soon.